confess to you, very briefly, once a theatre critic. It doesn't sit very well with an actor having to opine on the work of his brethren. And it was for Punch, though, you see, so it could be quite light-hearted. And you'd sit in the theatre with a Punch artist, very good ones they were, and they'd be drawing the actors, and you'd be thinking of things to say about them in Punch. It had been in the very early 70s, very, very early 70s. The only great pleasure I had was to review the first performance of the Rocky Horror Show. I saw it in a tiny little theatre, not even a theatre, a room, above the Royal Court. And it was an astounding evening. It was a very mean production. It needs to be pretty mean and lean and rough. It's become rather glossy and a sort of classic. And how strange to think that its author, Richard O'Brien, now has a statue erected to himself in a small town in New Zealand where he comes from. But I got to London in 1959. I missed out on quite a few people. A lot of people I wanted to meet when I came to London, but I was a little too nervous and sort of reticent to approach them. So I saw Augustus John only from a distance at the Royal Academy. He was clearly very drunk. But I did get to know John Betjeman very well. He became a close friend of mine. And because he'd been to Australia on a tour for the British Council, and someone had given him a little record of mine that I'd made of a monologue of Edna, I think, and Sandy Stone, who is a character who persists in my repertoire, a kind of ghost from the suburbs of Melbourne. And he wrote a piece about me, and then had never really actually seen me on the stage. Only when Peter Cook proposed that I appear at his club, the Establishment, which was, I suppose, to use a term not then current, cutting edge venue, where I was a dismal failure. And I remember the Bamba Gascoigne described me as soporific, which is true probably, compared with the entertainments they'd had, which was all political satire. I remember David Frost also appearing there. But my forte was this regional monologue, I suppose. And it must have seemed very folksy and very esoteric. I still, you know, secretly think of myself as a Dadaist. And in my native Australia, I still quite accidentally seem to arouse a great deal of anxiety. I seem to have a provocative gift. Never really thought of myself as a comedian. I don't mind what I get called, but I'm determined to do the best show I can. And, you know, I won't be able to go on doing the best show I can because I'm getting actually quite old. My parents were not theatre-goers at all. But I would sometimes go to matinees with my mother. And they would be the sort of things we had in Australia. They would be West End shows, farces generally, or Sub-Ratigan. I mean, I love Terence Rattigan. And I'm thrilled by the revival of his work. But they would be an Australian company, but they always had to bring out an English star or two, sometimes husband and wife teams, who were, by then, back numbers in England. But we presented them as direct from the West End, and they would bumble around on the stage, and my mother would say, who'd admired them in movies, she would whisper to me very loudly, isn't it pathetic at his age? Now when I'm on stage and I have a little illumination in the audience and I see a woman with a schoolboy leaning forward and whispering something, I know exactly what she's saying. Or I think I have a feeling that's what she's saying. Or I hope I will not persist until she does have to say it. You know, until I'm having to use an earpiece for prompting until there are long silences before I say anything, until I forget where I am. I think when I appear in London, it'll be quite an emotional thing for me to play in London. Wimbledon, fine, great. You know. Edinburgh and Milton Keynes and Cardiff, marvellous, you know. Warming it up for the town, big town. Don't know what theatre we're in yet, but I hope it's one which has a kind of variety tradition. The stage shows that I've done, they all derived really from some recordings that I made many years ago. In the 50s, really, I wrote monologues, and then there was a local company in Melbourne which recorded things, recorded limited editions of Australian poetry, things of that kind, and they approached me about recording some of these monologues, and so I wrote specifically for the gramophone record. I did record the Dame Edna, the first Dame Edna sketch, which was about the Olympic Games. That had been done in the theatre, but my character of Sandy Stone, who's the old man of the suburbs and subsequently a ghost, I wrote specially for this recording company and never intended to present this old man in the theatre. And a colleague of mine persuaded me that it would be quite good as a monologue on stage. I was doubtful, but it worked. The intention of the character of Sandy was really to see how long an audience could sit there while someone droned on about the minutiae of Melbourne suburban life. No jokes, nothing funny. It was comedy purged of humour, really. And I felt it was quite new in its own way. It certainly was very new to make jokes about how most Australians really did live. No outback, no corks on hats, no marsupials, no aborigines, just a kind of tropical Wembley. And so these recordings took on a special meaning, especially for Australians who lived in London. And I was told people played them. When they got the impulse to go back to Australia, they played them, and it acted as a deterrent. It reminded them of the boredom of Australian life at that time. I never found it boring myself, because I was always fascinated in that sort of thing. And when I go back to Melbourne, as I do several times a year, and my children live there, I just cruise around the suburbs. And despite all the progress, despite the high rises and the Americanization of Australia and the Orientalization of Australia, the suburbs are the same, exactly the same, not changed. And so these characters, both Edna and Sandy, were about suburban Melbourne. And really, they've been in the repertoire ever since. But the time came late last year, when I decided that I would do a farewell season, because I was tired of the touring, as I explained to you when we talked earlier. I mean, I like the touring, but I just physically can't keep on doing it. A terrible admission, isn't it, of infirmity? And so I thought, well, I better make it the best show I could. And I was very pleased with what resulted. Brian Thompson, whom I knew many, many years ago, who designed my first London show, a lot of little gnomes all over the stage. There were garden gnomes everywhere. And then later he designed, of course, the Rocky Horror Show, Jesus Christ Superstar, more recently, Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. He became quite a big-time theatre designer. He designed a set for me, which was really a suburban backyard. So the audience come in and they see lawn, a shed, tool shed, a fence, the profiles of neighbouring houses, television aerials, and the house of Well, it turns out to be Les Patterson's house, jutting onto the set. And my pianist, who's a very interesting Balinese young man from Bali, is from Bali. And so he is seen as like a gardener, clipping the hedges, mowing the lawn, sweeping up. When the audience come in, they see just this rather domestic detail, into which Les Patterson implodes. And Les is in very abundant mood, and he is a celebrity chef for the purpose of the show, and does a cooking and demonstration in presence of the audience. And that is a big, and sings a song about cuisine. And this is about the changes in our diet, what we now eat, which we never thought of eating before. And this applies, I think, to all of us. You know, I don't think very many of our generation, certainly not mine, were brought up and knew what a snow pea was, you know, or tasted endive, or any of these exotic things, pappardelle, goat's cheese, which is ubiquitous, of course, we never tasted, never knew what it was. So Les comes on, the beautiful girl dancers join him, two members of the audience come up and help the cooking demonstration, eat this food that Les has prepared, reluctantly, I might say. And while Les is briefly off stage, attending to a matter of hygiene, personal hygiene, his brother comes on stage. His brother is a priest. So different from Les that the audience don't even know that it's the same actor. Well, I like to think that they don't know it. Les Patterson is an actor. Les Patterson is. So is his brother, Gerard. And there's a conflict between Les and his brother, achieved magically on stage. A seance takes place because the brother is an exorcist, apart from other things. Explosions, phantoms appear, and when the smoke settles, Sandy Stone, the old ghost of Melbourne, appears, bewildered. A brief visitor to the planet, and he talks mostly on themes of old age, his wife who is still alive in an old folks home, and what life is like there and for him, and on a whole range of subjects, which brings Act One to a close when the audience have seen three different characters, that's right. Act two is time for Edna's arrival, who has recently been on an ashram, so Edna enters in a very exotic fashion. And again, there's a great deal of audience involvement, and she talks a lot about current things, which have been, of course, touched on by Les, who's a politician, and so the present state of world politics receives a definitive analysis from Les. When Edna comes on, she's mostly concerned about her family, about which she talks in some rather contemptuous detail. We hear all about the latest activities of her gay son, her lesbian daughter. In short, the dysfunctional family, of which she's still rather proud. Her deceased bridesmaid Madge. There are several songs, there's dancing, there's audience participation on rather a grand scale. And a riotous finale in which the traditional ending of the show is respected, that is to say, gladioli, worth thousands of dollars, and imported from Australia, by the way, are distributed to the audience. As many people as possible go home with a rather healthy-looking Gladdy. And above all, you know, it's just performing on the stage that I like doing. People say, oh, we don't see you much on television, but that's really because I'm a stage person. I like to be in direct contact with the audience. After all, when I first came to London as a student actor, I went out to the Metropolitan Music Hall, which was in the Edgware Road, right underneath the big motorway. Gone now, long ago. And I saw old-time performers, which I've actually become